So, good evening, everybody. This is, I couldn't believe it. I looked at the thing. It's been week 8. That's amazing. And we're going to, of course, have a 2-week break after tonight, like the whole world. So, some of us weren't here last week. Quick refresher. What did we talk about? Anybody? Talked a lot about Supreme Court, Justice Aharon Barak, and the precedents that they set, and how they kind of mesh law, right? Israeli law we talked about, can cite Turkish law, although less so as the years go by, British law, American law, and Jewish law, halakha. In fact, we talked a little bit about how in some rulings, in particular, such as when Yigal Amir, the man who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin, was sentenced, the modern Orthodox judge read to him why it was against Jewish law what he did. And that was part of the record. That's another one of those only in Israel types of things. You are not going to be quoting the New Testament if you're sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court. You might want to, but you're not going to. And correct me if I'm wrong, because you know the law much better than I do, obviously. Did they ever do that?
In the U.S.?
Yeah.
Rarely.
Rarely. Okay. In Israel, just another day in paradise. What else did we talk about? Right, Aharon Barak, Justice Aharon Barak, who was the guy in the 80s and 90s who made it what's called an activist court, which some really don't like and some really do like. You know, as they say in the Talmud, it depends on whose ox is being gored. Anything else?
Different branches of government.
We talked about the Knesset. We talked about the different types of courts in Israel. There's a labor court in Israel because labor has played such an important role there. We talked about the elections a little bit. Knesset members, parliament, the 3.5%, 3.25% threshold that will be in this election. Last election it was 2 or 2.25, something like that. By the way, a quick aside, if you follow the news from Israel Daily, it's real horse trading right now in terms of what party's joining what party and who's going to run with what list. And one of the reasons is because the threshold has been picked up to 3.25%. So whereas in the state's first few decades, if you had 1% of the election, you got electorate, you got a seat in the Knesset, or 1.25, whatever it was. Today, it's got to be 3.25. There will be no more parties with 2% in getting a seat. So, for example, a party like Kadima, which now has 2, and at one point was in the 30s, the high 30s, will likely have to join another list to survive. And we've already seen Yesh Atid, not Yesh Atid, Labor and Tnuva. I want to say Tnuva, which is the dairy products company. Yeah, cheese, all that stuff. There's a great kiddie song about the truck from Tnuva coming to your neighborhood. So you're seeing a lot of that going on, and it's because of, in part, what we talked about last week. And let's see, we talked about the army a little bit. And not just how it was formed, but the role that it plays in Israeli society, and in the army,
education.
What?
Some kind of laws.
Which laws for what?
Because they don't have constitution.
Oh, the basic laws. The basic laws, right? When we're talking about the court and the rule of law in general, and how that serves. As Barak was actually the guy who said it. Outstanding. But we did talk about education and the challenge of the Zionists to create an educational system. And one of the, at least for me, scary statistics that we talked about is that in not too many years, 5, 6, 7 years, 50% of the first graders in Israel will either be Haredi or Arabs. 50%, which means non-Zionist. So, you know, there's some real challenges there facing the Jewish state. All right, anything else from last week? All right, outstanding. This week, we're going to do the very difficult topic, very emotional topic, and very interesting topic of the ways the Holocaust or the Shoah has shaped the modern state of Israel. And it really challenged the whole ethos of the founding generation. We'll get that to that in a moment. But, you know, the state wasn't meant initially to be a refuge, right? What was it meant to be? Place to create the new Jew. Right? And we're leaving all that behind, and then all of a sudden, all that comes back to us. All right, we're going to talk about Kastner, the famous Kastner Fair in Israel. We're going to talk about, just in general, historically, how the state has gone about memorialization. We're going to talk about the bitter reparations slash normalization fight with Germany in the early 50s. You know, not long at all after the war. I'm going to talk about Eichmann in Jerusalem. And finally, I have a brief, like, two-minute video, which for me is always very moving, about the IDF planes flying over Auschwitz, which is really, always gets me when I see it. Always, definitely always gets me. All right. So as I mentioned before, the state was founded by people who ran away from the shtetl, from orthodoxy, from Yiddish, which they called jargon. Although, you know, many people also in English, I don't know if you guys find this, they say, you know, oh, does she speak Jewish? You know, that means Yiddish. I've heard that on and off all my life. All of a sudden, World War II comes, and even before that, from 1933 on, we see an increase in immigration from Germany and Central Europe coming to Palestine. You know, there was a limit, there was a quota, but the majority of people, not all of them, were like that. And in the mid-30s, there was also a depression in Poland, so a lot of Polish Jews started showing up. These people were shopkeepers, they were middle class, some were upper middle class. They were not the pioneering labor ethos that we had been used to. They were not Gedud Avodah, the work brigades that we were used to in the 1920s. They weren't interested in setting up collectives for women, which we saw at one point in the 1920s, or anything else. They wanted Tel Aviv. Some went to Jerusalem, particularly if they were more observant-oriented, but Tel Aviv starts booming in this era as well. So then all of a sudden, after the war, there's 250,000 Jews in displaced person camps in the Allied zone. There's none in the Russian zone, but they are particularly in the British and the American zones. Zionist activity was strong in the camps. Haganah people went. They encouraged people to learn Hebrew, to study Jewish history, to prepare themselves for life in Palestine, what was going to become Israel. It wasn't uncommon to see a Zionist flag, which is the Israeli flag, flying, people singing Hatikvah. It led to tremendous demonstrations. I'm sure you've seen some of the films about "Let us go to Palestine. That's the only place where we want to go." You saw some of that in the movie Exodus, if you looked at that. We see those types of efforts around then, too. There were some training farms in these displaced person camps. They didn't serve a lot of people, but that concept was there. The survivors were interesting. They were obviously a mix of what was in Europe. They were Haredi, they were Reform, they were secular, they were socialist, they were whatever, whatever. Until now, the vast majority of people going to Palestine had some type of Zionist sense that they grew up with. Even in the 30s, when they were coming from Germany and Palestine, you know, if they could, they went to America or England or places like that, but they had generally some type of Zionist sense. They were intermarried. There's a lot of that going on, particularly in Germany and Austria. As I mentioned, many spoke jargon, and many had European manners. So you would go to a cafe in Tel Aviv in 1946, 48, and maybe you still see a little bit of it today, and you'd see these older men sitting there in jackets and ties, drinking coffee, reading the newspaper, looking out. It's like a cafe in Berlin. Does anybody know the nickname for Germans in Hebrew or in Israel?
Yeki.
Yeki. Do you know what it comes from?
They wore
jackets.
They wore
a jacket. So they would stroll the promenade in Tel Aviv in the evening wearing their jackets, meaning sports coats. Again, not the farming values that we're used to in terms of the history of the majority of the Zionist movement at this point.
I was told that the jacket that they were referred to was they all wore three-piece suits. They wore vests.
Yes.
Even
yes, there's great pictures. There's in pocket watches and the whole deal. They were middle, upper middle class people. Let's see. Few, although some were socialists, all were emotionally and physically scarred. If you think about it, today, to our credit as a society, we talk about the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and we say they have PTSD, we need to counsel them, we need more money for this. Think of what these people went through. They were all scarred. They weren't escaping Europe to go to Palestine. Their Europe was gone. They weren't writing letters home. Some of them, as we know, of course, did try to go home, and there were pogroms like in Kielce in Poland and other places. the meaning of the state shifts, in my view. It's now a home for refuge. It's rescue and relief. And it's really going to stay that way in many regards until today. Right? We've talked a little bit about French Jewry in this class, and how many are going to go, and how many are not going to go, and whether they feel threatened or whatever. But you have wave after wave of Jews who soon can't stay in their homeland because of riots, because of, you know, dual loyalty issues, because of fear, and particularly for the Sephardim / Mizrachim, some Zionism mixed in there too, for sure. For sure. But for many of these people, this was the place they could go. Because no one else wanted them. Right? We know that Britain, till the last moment, was stopping ships. Literally the week before May 15th, they were stopping ships from coming in. Just crazy. The United States didn't want them. In fact, the United States was pressuring Great Britain to let them come to Palestine. And the United States, by the way, was still not filling its quotas for refugees / immigrants. And we certainly saw that in the 1930s as well. And if anything, because you know they couldn't get out during the war, you would think the United States might lift it, raise the ceiling a little in the years right after the war. But that wasn't going to happen.
So in the camps, was there a feeling of community?
Some of the camps were open until the early 50s. Some people were in there 4, 5, 6 years. So there was a sense of community, and there were numerous camps. A couple of them were large. Most of them were kind of medium, maybe, you know, thousands of people, but not necessarily tens of thousands of people by any stretch of the imagination. They did have a sense of community, and that was one of the things that the Haganah really tried to cultivate in them. And the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee was working there. There was a lot of Jewish relief efforts going on in the DP camps. And if you ever have the opportunity, the Holocaust Museum in D.C. has a nice section on that. Actually, I don't know if there was a rotating exhibit or not. But
I just want to make one comment that BHI has a really interesting collection of books from the Jewish Cultural Reconstruction Project, where they redistributed all these books that couldn't be repatriated to their owners. Mm. And one of the really most amazing pieces in that collection is a set of Talmud, missing one line, that was made by the U.S. government for the DP camps. And it is, we do these white glove sessions, so if anyone's interested, we can do them individually, or if you guys want to come as a group one day, to the library. It's really, really moving to just even see the front cover with like the eagle and the scene of Jerusalem printed on the front page of the Talmud. So
I remember a few years ago you had an exhibit of it, and I went to that, and they had
when we first brought it over.
Yeah, after the war there were tens of thousands, if not more, of Jewish books. They couldn't find the owners for them anymore, so they gave them to all the Jewish libraries and collections around the country. Yeah, in the late 40s. It's really, I remember looking at a Maimonides book from like hundreds of years ago, and it was really amazing. In German, actually.
One piece was actually given to a family in Baltimore. Somehow one of the librarians figured out that this family was in Baltimore, relatives, and they gave it to them.
Wow.
It's really, really.
Yeah.
There's some of those.
It's a great collection over there. I mean, I certainly spent many Sundays with that collection. All right. So, of course, the man is Ben-Gurion. Remember, he is in power from about 1920, not about, from 1920 to 1963. Right? He first takes over the Histadrut in 1920. He resigns for the final time as prime minister in 1963. And I put this up here because this is the latest book about Ben-Gurion. It's relatively short and it's good. Yeah. It says it's by Shimon Peres, but really David Landau wrote it. David Landau is the past editor of Haaretz, and that's who authored the book I'm now reading about Ariel Sharon. But this is a good book. This is in the Next Book series, which is a neat little series. It's been coming out for about 6 or 7 years. Every 3 or 4 months, something like that, they put out a book. It's really a nice collection.
What series did you
name? NEXT book. Next Book. And I believe it's put out in coordination with tabletmag.com. And so Tablet Mag, which is a great Jewish website, has some information about the stuff on there. They have links to it. All right. So what did Ben-Gurion get out of the Holocaust? Remember, Ben-Gurion is one of the guys who's running from Europe. Right? He left that world behind to create a new world. So Israel is not going to get support from the rest of the world. Okay, whatever you get is great, take it, but we're basically on our own. And that's something that's lasted until today. Netanyahu certainly feels that. And we're going to talk to him about him a little bit in terms of the legacy of the Holocaust and the Iranian nuclear efforts. So this is something that, and Ariel Sharon certainly felt that, Menachem Begin certainly felt that, and Golda Meir certainly felt that, you know, during the Yom Kippur War. Even a guy like Moshe Dayan felt that during the Yom Kippur War, and we'll get to that as we move on in time, but, you know, at one point, I think it was the second or third day of the war, he said, I fear the Third Temple will be lost. I fear the Third Temple, because that's an analogy to the state, the Third Temple. Anyway, he said that support could be fickle, but you must cultivate it. Right? Israel is not going to make it on its own, but it still can't necessarily fully trust anyone else. Right? Did you want to say something?
No, I'm just moving my arm.
All right, corner of my eye, caught me. Without military strength, the Jewish people are doomed. Ben-Gurion had always been strong on military matters. Remember, he held the defense ministry while he was prime minister. And that's something that Yitzhak Rabin did as well. Ariel Sharon did it for a little bit as well. Netanyahu did it during a coalition crisis. He held it. He personally oversaw military matters, because it's not going to happen again. And that's behind, we talked about one week, the nuclear aspirations of Israel. That was behind part of that as well. If we have that, they're not going to come get us. They're not going to be able to come get us. Because if you think about it, by the way, economically, politically, religiously, what does the nuclear bomb do for Israel?
That's why they don't admit whether they have it or not.
Right, we talked about nuclear ambiguity. We will not be the first ones to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. That's how they always say it when they're asked if they have the bomb, basically. But basically what it is, it's their ultimate insurance policy. And then, because we're speaking about the Holocaust, there's an insurance policy for the insurance policy. The Germans have given, as well as sold Israel, Dolphin-class submarines, which launch nuclear missiles. It is a what's called second strike capability. For Israel sitting out the Gulf War in 1991, the Germans gave them two Dolphin-class submarines. Now, the U.S. probably paid for it, but the Germans gave it to them for staying out of the coalition and not mucking things up, basically. All right, so Israel cannot afford to lose the war. There is no tomorrow. That's the ideology, right? It's, you know, it's one of the hardline sentiments has always been, if the Arabs put down their weapons, there'll be peace tomorrow. If Israel puts down its weapons, there'll be no Israel tomorrow. So you can debate that, but that's one of the ideologies behind this.
I mean, you know, they have lost wars in, like, the Lebanon.
Yes, but that was also a war by choice and not...
Yeah, necessity.
And it also was necessity. It also was an 18-year war,
yeah,
with various ups and downs. So it, you know... And by the way, you could look at the Lebanon War a little differently. You can say, kick the PLO out of southern Lebanon, get Arafat out of there, stop missiles from shelling the north.
But although that really didn't happen in the long run.
Well, that's because Hezbollah filled the void, but they got the PLO out, and that was their goal. That it created, that's the impossibility, the impossible situation for Israel.
It's a kind of a stalemate with Gaza now, Hamas.
Right.
It's not really, they haven't... but they really haven't won.
Well, and, you know, not to get too modern, because God forbid we get too modern in here, Hamas can't defeat Israel. It can only make Israel miserable, which it can do.
There was that expression, there can be no danger of Israel losing with Egypt, but no peace with Syria. That's changed a little bit, maybe.
Syria is totally unpredictable at this point. It could get a lot worse. As the Jewish optimist always says, you know the definition of a Jewish optimist? Somebody who says, today's a good day. I know that, because tomorrow's going to be worse. Anyway, Jewish strength was limited, so you had to be practical. Remember, back in 1937, Ben-Gurion accepted partition. And Ben-Gurion correctly said after the war how different it would have been if partition had gone through in 1937. And we had that slice of the coast. And then going inland a little bit in the north, think of the refugees that we could have saved. And by the way, one of the amazing stories of Israel has always been the absorptive capacity of the land and the ingenuity of the Israelis slash Jews for making that happen. The British kept saying, you can only bring in this much because that's all the land can take. And look what's happened since then. Now there's 7.3 million people living there.
The assumption, of course, is had they taken the land in 37, that the Allies or the Axis would have allowed them to bring in refugees on ships.
That's true, but there would have been a place for them to, the ships to target. The British wouldn't necessarily have been able to patrol everything because Israel would have had whatever, I think it's 20 miles for international coastline out to international sea lanes. So then they could have come straight in there. They could, they might not necessarily have been able to go further south, but Haifa, I think, was in, it was in the territory, for example. And a lot of them tried, did try to get there, particularly around Athlit and the beaches like that. So, but I understand what you're saying, definitely. The conventional imbalance with the Arabs must be met unconventionally. That just didn't mean nuclear weapons. It also meant daring tactics and really creating a remarkable military machine. So I'll read, this Ben-Gurion speaks to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy, by the one, is the first American president to sell weapons to Israel. Remember, there had been an embargo by the United States and some other European countries, which countries like the Czechs broke, against selling weapons in the Middle East. Against selling weapons in the Middle East, he sold, I think it was Tomahawk missiles? Tomahawk missiles in 62. Whoops, there it is again. I know that it's difficult for civilized people to visualize another Holocaust. Even after they have witnessed what happened to us during the Second World War, I do not assume that could happen today or tomorrow, but I cannot dismiss the possibility that this may occur if the situation in the Middle East remains as it is and the Arab leaders continue to insist and pursue their policy of belligerency against Israel. As a Jew, I know the history of my people and carry with me the memories of all it has endured over a period of 3,000 years and the effort it has cost to accomplish what has been achieved in this country in recent generations. Mr. President, my people have the right to exist both in Israel and wherever they may live, and this existence is in danger. So that's pretty strong stuff. But what I also want you to pay attention to is he's not saying, we've come to this land to create a new Jew. We've come to this land, it's expression, leave note, to build and to be built. He's saying, I identify with 3,000 years of Jewish history. It didn't stop with Bar Kokhba in 135. By the way, Ben-Gurion, his name is the name of a general in Bar Kokhba's army. So, you know, that's where he got it from. It was David Gruen, or Green. So that was the mentality of really the benevolent dictator, the benevolent democratic dictator of Israel's history. Any more questions on this before we move on? Awesome. All right, so the big task, of course, was resettling the survivors. You just fought a war. We went through this 1 week when we talked about the economy. The economy is a wreck. These people are streaming in. They don't have relatives who can take them in. Their relatives are gone. They're not coming like the Arabs are, the Jews from Arab lands are. Basically, we might be miserable, but our whole family's together in this camp, this Ma'abara. So after the war, the United States is pushing Great Britain. It says, let 100,000 in immediately. The American Jewish establishment was pushing that as well. Brits basically said no. Truman's screaming. He's saying, you know, I want this to happen. I'm getting a lot of pressure from the Jews in the Democratic Party and their friends. So the Brits say, okay, we'll put together what's known as the Anglo-American Commission of Inquiry. Anglo-American Commission of Inquiry goes there, meets, talks to a whole bunch of people, and they basically said, yeah, let 100,000 in. Americans say, great, let 100,000 in. Brits ignore it. Remember, they had said before the war, 75,000 for 5 years. And then, with the consent of the majority of the population, we'll let more in. Well, the majority of the population at that point still would have been overwhelmingly Arab. So they weren't going to allow any more to come in. The Brits certainly knew that. So that was, you know, Bevin at one point in Britain actually said, they should be repatriated in Europe. Now, The knee-jerk reaction is to say that's pretty anti-Semitic, right? I'm not apologizing for Bevin at all, because he's one of the creeps of modern history. But what he was saying, in part, was that everyone else in Europe is being repatriated to their homes. Let the Jews be repatriated to their homes. Of course, the Jews were seen as another nation in Europe, right? There were Poles and there were Jews in Poland. You'd identify probably differently today, but the Jews were a group apart. We talked about the Zionist activity in the camps. After the state total, not just from the DP camps, over the years about 500,000 Jews came in from Europe. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people in a state this size. Now, there were about 300,000 Mizrahi Sephardi Jews that came in, so there's still an overwhelming percentage of Sephardi. Very sadly, up to 2,000 could have died in the War of Independence. We don't have exact stats. I was looking at some stuff. There's some letters from them and all that. Literally, some of them were given guns when they got off the boat and sent to a battlefield. Didn't understand Hebrew. They were killed because they didn't know when to retreat, when to move forward, or what have you. Some survived and told stories about it. But that was a very, very sad chapter, actually. All right, 49, some of the survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto founded Kibbutz Lochmei HaGeta'ot, which means Fighters of the Ghetto. See the word ghetto in there. Have any of you ever been to the Ghetto Fighters Museum up there? It's in the north. It's been there. It's a neat little place. Now it's actually pretty big. I don't know how the last time we were on there. I went on their website. It's grown a lot since I was there. Not surprising, though. It's between Akko and Nahariya. It's a neat place to stop. This was the first Holocaust museum in the world. First Holocaust museum in the world was created there in the early 50s by the survivors. And these were survivors of Jewish... They were in Jewish youth groups. If you know about the Warsaw Ghetto, you know Mordechai Anilevich. He was a Jewish youth group leader, as were a number of the fighters in the ghetto itself. And that's the outside. They found an outside Roman amphitheater, of course, when they kibbutz grounds. So now they use it for various programs. All right. So the state itself is going to get involved in commemorating the Holocaust. 1948, the Ministry of Religion created the Chamber of the Holocaust. This is the creepiest, ghouliest place I've ever been. Any of you guys ever been there? It's just on the edge of the old city. It's dark and dank and meant to echo, you know, just badness. And it really does. It's poorly lit, as you can see. They have neat artifacts, but it's no Yad Vashem. This was the first state-sponsored memorial to the Holocaust. It's on Mount Zion, where some of you might have been. That's where King David's... supposedly buried. It's also, there's something called the Diaspora Yeshiva there, and there's also an important scene from the life of Jesus is right there too. So there's a whole one, like everything, right, in Israel, piled on, piled on, piled on. So you get a lot of tourists coming through there. It's symbolic of redemption after the horrible battles, supposed to be at least. These dark caves lit by candles, you know, kind of men who are about 864 years old sitting there trying to explain things to you. It's meant to give you the feeling of the Holocaust in Jewish history. Now, it's interesting on a lot of levels. One in particular is that if it's supposed to reflect Jewish history, you would think you would be a little cheerier too. For example, if you've been to the Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv, right? That talks about the accomplishments of the Jewish people. And there's a lot of neat stuff. And they handled the Holocaust very well there, too, with the Scroll of Fire. This was pushed in the early, late 40s, early 50s, by a guy named Rabbi Samuel Zanville Kahana, no relation from what I understand. He oversaw the burial there of ashes of Holocaust victims and desecrated Torahs. So, really difficult stuff. The picture didn't come out well that I saw. The exhibit includes a blood-stained Torah. So, very graphic. Drums and wallets made from Torahs. Auschwitz prisoner uniforms. a recreation of a crematorium, and soap allegedly made by Nazis from human bones. This is very controversial. The Holocaust scholar Deborah Lipstadt has looked into this. She contends that never happened. Other people contend it did happen. Just the fact that we can even think about it happening is, you know, ghoulish enough. But if you're, you know, in the old city and you have some time, look for this. You should see it. It's worth your time. It's just a very different sense of what you get from the rest of Israel. So, and again, that's called the Chamber of the Holocaust. All right, of course we come to Yad Vashem. Raise your hand if you've been to Yad Vashem. What are some thoughts that come to mind? What stands out for you when dealing with Yad Vashem? Anybody?
Great sadness.
Great sadness. Anything else?
It's too crowded.
Very
those
crowded
soldiers
times.
Soldiers and the way they have those rooms.
Yes.
Really get this claustrophobic.
Right, and that's, by the way, one of the things we talked about last week is the IDF sees itself as a vehicle to inculcate Jewish values into soldiers. So they do take them to sites like that. Many of them have never been there. You know, particularly if you don't live in or around Jerusalem. You don't know from Jewish history. And we made the point last week that many people in this class, if not all, I think, know a lot more about Zionist history than a lot of those men and women, young men and women.
And the architecture, I think, intentionally does that to make you feel crowded as a part of what happened.
Well, the new building is much better than the old building.
They've sort of expanded it.
Yeah, if you've been to the new building in the last, I guess, 10 or 15 years, I don't know. Well, it was real low when you came in the original building. It's much broader now. The things that really stand out to me there, I'll never forget. First of all, I love the Avenue of the Righteous, the Righteous Gentiles. That's an incredible statement to me, you know, that there's some hope. And I'm so happy they did that. That when you walk up there on the left, you see the cattle car raised on railroad tracks. And that always gets me. You know, it's an authentic cattle car that they use to transport Jews to Poland. It's very moving. Interestingly, it's on the other side of the mountain of anybody know what?
Mount Herzl.
Mount Herzl, the national cemetery for not only the political leaders, but primarily for the soldiers who have died, and Herzl himself, of course. So there's a statement being made there.
Yeah. In the new museum in Warsaw, the Warsaw Ghetto Museum, mm-hmm. which is in the process of opening, they have the same sculpture that you have Yad Vashem against the wall.
Oh, yeah, that's Anilevich in the ghetto, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you walk up there, yeah, it's a really huge thing. That sculpture originally was in a square in Warsaw right by there, and I think they moved it to it.
In the museum.
Right, right. All right, so a couple things about Yad Vashem, and this is relatively new, the Hall of Photos. That's overwhelming. I mean, it really is. So the idea was raised back in September 1942 for a national memorial. They had no idea how bad it was at that point. They knew it was bad, but nothing like this. That was at a board of JNF by a kibbutznik, Mordechai Shinhavi, in August 45 after the war. The idea came back, and they said, we're going to do it. We're going to do it as, you know, that was the Jewish Agency for Palestine at that point. Provisional Board of Directors is established. February 46, British still control. Don't know if the British are going to leave or when they're going to leave at this point. They open an office in Jerusalem. 47, they hold a conference on the Holocaust, focused on research. Right, you've just had this, what's been called the most documented crime in history. How do you begin to gather the records? Who do you appeal to? Are you going to get them? Obviously, tons of academic questions come up. Independence War comes. Obviously, things are on hold. So in 53, the Knesset passes a law establishing a national memorial. The government had funded the Chamber of the Holocaust, but this was going to be the big deal, the national memorial, the official state memorial. The name, Yad Vashem, the hand, and God, or the Lord, comes from the book of Isaiah, and there's the quote from it: even unto them will I give in my house, and within my walls a place and a name, better than of sons and daughters. I will give them everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Yad also means memorial. Yad means hand, means Torah pointer, and it means memorial. Alright, so the main purposes of Yad Vashem, there we go up here, are education, research, memorialization, documentation, and commemoration. And like you said, it's a really busy place. It's a really busy place. They have a phenomenal website. A very good friend of mine, she lives across the street from me, her brother works in the archives there if anybody ever needs any information. You know, I'm happy to help you out with that. But they're really tremendous. One of the things that they do, which is fascinating to me, is they get as many Yisker books as they can from Jewish communities in Europe. They have a project where they put all that online. Anybody know why they do that?
It's a record of who was.
Trace your relatives. Trace your name. I'm, you know, for example, half of my family is from a shtetl called Alinka. I could go look at Alinka, Ukraine, and just start searching names. You know, and the last names might not work, right? Because names change when they come over here. But first names, Yitzhak Ben so-and-so. You know, stuff like that. All right, now we come to the fight of fights in Israel. Reparations with Germany. I obviously don't have to tell you guys that to say the wounds were raw in the early 50s is the understatement of the century. Here's a picture, by the way, of Konrad Adenauer, a very brave Chancellor of Germany, signing what was ultimately called the Luxembourg Agreements, because of where they signed it, which, you know, basically said they were going to give X amount of money to the State of Israel over a certain amount of years. And I might have told you guys that when I first went to Israel in 83, I remember saying to somebody, why are all the taxi cabs Mercedes? I said, reparations. You know, they were given not just financially, they were given goods as well. And that always struck me because, you know, in America, right, you know, taxi cab drivers don't drive Mercedes. But there they either got them free or next to free. So on September 51, Adenauer of West Germany addresses the parliament. Important to note, of course, that this is just West Germany. And it's one of the ways that Germany also rehabilitates itself in the eyes of the West. We've been ruling ourselves now, not even for 8 years, because we had occupation for a few years. There's still all types of restrictions. Our new constitution says our military can only do X, Y, and Z. Adenauer is a very brave guy. He steps forward and he says, unspeakable crimes have been committed in the name of the German people, calling for moral and material indemnity. The federal government are prepared, which I guess is in English, jointly with representatives of Jewry and the State of Israel, to bring about a solution of the material indemnity problem, thus easing the way to the spiritual settlement of infinite suffering. It's good. He was really good. He was really a good guy. You can imagine, not everybody in Germany was pleased with him. Right? There were, a country like Germany, there's plenty of ex-Nazis doing things like teaching your children, delivering your mail, operating on you, all types of things. So Adenauer stepped forward, and it was a bold statement. 1 month later, Nachum Goldman, chair of the Jewish Agency and president of the World Jewish Congress, calls a meeting in New York City of 23 Jewish groups to discuss. What should we do? How are we going to handle this? Do we even want to talk to Germany? I mean, basically, this happened yesterday. They created something which is still going today called the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany, better known as the Claims Conference. Now, the Claims Conference in recent years has had a few scandals about various staff and money being absconded. Henry's shaking his head. You've been involved with some of this.
No, but I know about it.
Right. But they have also, over the years, helped bring billions and billions of dollars to survivors, as well as the State of Israel. The huge issue, by the way, that's still on the table that'll never be solved is property, right? How do you compensate people for houses, for synagogues? Who do you give the money to? Jewish Community Center. So we'll take a look. I think we have how they calculated it, or at least what they did then.
Isn't art right now a big one?
Art's a big one, and periodically you hear of a piece of art in some museum's collection that happened to be with the Bronstein family, and they find out about that, and they do repatriate that in general. But you do periodically hear about those types of things. What?
You have to have the provenance of the art.
Right.
And that German guy that has the 1,100
pieces. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Oh, yeah, tablet. That magazine actually did a big piece on him.
Well, he's dead, but it's his son now.
There's a lot of that out there. You know, the truth of the matter is, you can't compensate people for what you did to them. You can't. So there's a big fight, right? In American and Palestinian, Israeli groups, where do you put the money? Do you put the money into the state of Israel, or do you try and help the survivors here, or do you try and help the survivors in Poland, right? And Russia or Soviet Union, do you try and get money to them? Do you negotiate with the Soviets? You know, there's a lot going on here. All right. Keep in mind that in Israel, there's an economic crisis. This is very important to keep in mind. We've just fought a major war. We have hundreds of thousands of immigrants coming in. We have to spend millions, if not billions, on military weapons because the next war could start tomorrow, if not tonight. Our foreign currency reserves are very low. Ben-Gurion comes out and says, we need the money. Again, very controversial. You're putting a price on my aunt's life. He said the right decision. It's the right decision for an independent people. Others called it blood money. Guess what? They're both right. There are two approaches. This is Ben-Gurion. One is the ghetto Jews approach, and the other is of an independent people. See, he's always digging, we're the new Jews. I don't want to run after a German and spit in his face. I don't want to run after anybody. I want to sit here and build here. I'm not going to go to America to take part in a vigil against Adenauer. All right, so Ben-Gurion does not mince his words. This is the right thing because I know how bad we are economically. So then, there is a useless verse in the Bible. Wipe out the memory of Amalek. If the Amalekites lived today and had universities, Jews would be studying in them. Wow. Anybody know the reference to Amalek?
He was the one.
You kill the man, you kill the women, you kill the children, you kill the goats. Nothing left. And what did the Jews do? Who did they let live?
Was it Sisera?
The women.
No.
Basically. And I don't know if they killed the goats. So, it was the women, right? Yeah. So Amalek is the evil in Jewish history. They say Haman was descended from Amalek. They say Hitler was descended from Amalek. All right, this is the evil thing to mention in Jewish history. And I just love that. If the Amalekites had universities, Jews would be studying in them. It's just, that's Ben-Gurion.
Aaron had a teacher at Beth Tefillah when he was a kid who made them write Amalek on the bottom of their shoes.
Oh, yeah, because you're supposed to wipe out the memory.
He talks about that.
Yeah, this is one of the great paradoxes, by the way. I love the Jewish people. Whenever we say the name Amalek, we're supposed to say, may his name be wiped out. But we say his name.
You have to remember to forget Amalek.
Yeah, you have to remember to forget. Yeah, I don't know. My philosophy lessons aren't that good, but I think there's a problem there. All right. He also said 6 billion of Jewish property was pillaged by the Nazis. So negotiations begin also between Adenauer and Moshe Sharet, who's the foreign minister at that point. Well, this was a great issue for the opposition, certainly for the Chabad party, Menachem Begin's party, and the General Zionists, the GZ party, which generally aligned with him and ultimately would merge, by the way, to make Likud in 73. Well, they emerged in the early 60s. And some of Mapam was the near-communist group. Right? Somebody, by the way, mentioned last week, do they still have a communist group in Israel, and I said Chadash, and I forgot, it's actually called Maki now. So M-A-K-I, and it's primarily Arab, but there's still some Jews involved in it. When it started, it was 50-50 Jewish-Arab, and they were in all the early Knessets. Because remember, communism was a different thing then than it is today. Yaakov Chazan of Mapam in the Knesset. Nazism is rearing its ugly head again in Germany, and our so-called Western friends are nurturing that Nazism. They are resurrecting Nazi Germany. These are tough charges. Our army, the Israel Defense Forces, will be in the same camp as the Nazi army, and the Nazis will begin infiltrating here, not as our most terrible enemies, but rather as our allies. Stay away from the Germans, is what they're saying. Nothing good is going to come from that experience. We know that. We already know that. Ben-Gurion continued. Demonstrations continued. It got a little bit uglier. One day, on January 7th, 52, the Knesset debates the issue. Remember, this is the first Knesset house in Jerusalem. I think it was the Frohman building. It's not the Jewish Agency one, I know that. It wasn't there that long. Police surrounded the area. Police were ready. The surrounding roads were blocked. Barbed wire was set up. Fences were put around the Knesset. The IDF patrolled the area. Police had batons and tear gas. Still, 15,000 people got into the area. You know, there's all types of ways to get in. Begin gives a fiery speech. He refers to the Altalena. Someone remind me of what happened on the Altalena.
Tried to land guns. Fired on the...
Ben-Gurion ordered Rabin to fire.
And Begin.
Well, and Begin was on the ship. That's right. Because it was during one of the truces in the Independence War.
He wouldn't give up his arms.
He wanted him to go to your gun units. And Ben-Gurion said, no, this is a united army now. We don't play that game. So Begin says, when you fired at me with cannon, I gave the order, don't return fire. Today I will give the order, do. True, Ben-Gurion will show us no mercy. He knows this. But this time we will have no mercy on you. This will be a war of life or death. Politician, getting the crowd worked up. And Germany must be expelled forever from the family of nations. There should be no payment to blood accounts. Now, there is no more emotional issue at this point that you can deal with in Israel other than this. It turns violent. Protesters throw stones at the Knesset's windows. Police on horseback move in to disperse them. It's mayhem. They use tear gas. Using tear gas on Jews in Israel is pretty controversial. Gas? You're going to gas us? Are you out of your mind about Germany? 5 hours later, hundreds are arrested. 200 protesters and 140 policemen are injured. Thank God nobody was killed. Probably the most violent protest Israel has ever seen. The withdrawal from Gaza in 2005 was not violent. Right? It was long and large and loud, but it did not get violent. Inside the Knesset, Begin finally goes inside because, he's a Knesset member. Begin speaks. A hail of stones shatter the windows on one side. Everybody moves to the other side. He keeps on speaking. He goes on. Begin and Ben-Gurion are shouting at each other. And the chairman says, we're adjourned. They come back in later. They vote on it. It gets approved. Because remember, Ben-Gurion's party, I don't remember which point we're at here, has about 50 seats. All he needs is 10 more. That's nothing compared to today. Anybody know how many seats Netanyahu's Likud has?
22, maybe 20.
I think it's like 28, because Livni had 20. Oh, that was the last election. It's somewhere in there. It's somewhere in there. Yeah, the one before that, it was 28 and 29 with Livni. Anyway, it's nothing compared to what these guys had at this point. This was really the high point of a single party power in Israel. Lingering bitterness. A guy named Dov Shilansky He's arrested outside the Ministry of Foreign Affairs with a bomb in his briefcase. He's from the Lehi. We still have those guys around. There's a couple small units of these guys still operating. A lot of them have gone, like Yitzhak Shamir, into a group called the Mossad. All right, so we're not going to hear from them again for a while. We're not going to hear from Shalansky for a while. He was in Kheirut. He was on the Altalena. He's a Holocaust survivor. They give him 2 years in jail. He gets out. He goes to law school. Good Jewish boy. Becomes a member of the ethics committee of the Israel Bar. He becomes Speaker of the Knesset from 88 to 92. Right? There's another radical group called Malchut Yisrael, or the Kingdom of Israel. They send bombs to Adenauer and others. All right? Now, this is something that the Jewish Defense League would do in this country in the late 60s to the Soviets. Right? They actually did bomb the consulate in New York City, and they were trying to send some other bombs, too. They're all former Lehi members. They planned attacks on Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union, which is interesting because, of course, we know that Czechoslovakia armed Israel in its early years. And these are the boys in jail. They would eventually get out, and they would do all types of things like Dov Shalansky go into politics. Yeah.
But these guys, the men were from, had been in Europe and were now in Israel?
Some, not all, some. Like Shalansky was a Holocaust survivor.
Okay, so he got to Israel after 45, 46, yeah. And he hit the ground running.
Exactly. You know, these are young men who are radicalized by a horrible situation. Right? And, you know, to play amateur psychologist, they have nothing to lose. Their families are gone. You know, they're finally in a place where they can express who they want to be. It's bad terminology to say it, but they're acting out to the nth degree. Okay.
How we doing? Good. Time for another one.
Protests were for naught. It was approved 61 to 50 in the Knesset. Not a real comfortable margin, but good enough. $3 billion over 14 years. That's $3 billion in 1952 dollars. So that's a, you know, it's a lot of money today. You know, think about it then. It was officially paid to the World Jewish Congress. I'm guessing there was some German or Israeli law against, maybe there was some German law about giving money directly to another country, I don't know. Who gave it to the State of Israel for victims who had no surviving family. Officially, it was for slave labor, persecution, and stolen property. The money was critical. It was a huge boost to the economy. You know, instantly we had foreign reserves. Why do we want foreign reserves? We take the money and we put it in a foreign bank. Why do we want that? Anybody know?
Well, it supports the global currency.
Yeah, you can borrow other money. You've got something for collateral. Absolutely. So it goes to, a lot of it goes for infrastructure, it's equipment and raw material for government-owned companies. An example, 53 to 63, it funded one-third of the investment in the Israel electrical system. Hugely important. Remember, 1 million immigrants. Running water, electricity, you know, food stipends, what have you. Bought 50 ships, or at that point, two-thirds of Israel's merchant marines.
Yeah, Zim, I hear, was created from that.
Zim, yeah. It was created around then. I didn't know that, actually. I'm going to look that up. It provided for 45,000 jobs. That's a pretty good deal. So here's my question to you. See, yeah, maybe we'll do that one. See, another uncomplicated question. How do you feel about negotiating with Germany only 8 years after the Holocaust? What do you think?
Well, actually, a question.
Yeah.
How did Germany come up with all this money? Weren't they financially...
Germany was recovering relatively quickly, and a lot of money was being pumped into the economy because the Allies realized that they didn't want Germans to be angry and destitute.
Like after World War
I.
Exactly. 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 But Germany, you know, recovered, West Germany, recovered relatively quickly. And keep in mind, there were a lot of, for a number of years, a lot of soldiers from other countries there spending money.
Well, they were also there was a buffer against the Russians.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's definitely part of the Cold War to rehabilitate West Germany. you know, hugely important. Hugely important. So what do you guys think? How would you have felt in 53?
Typical Israeli practicality.
Yeah. But not everybody agreed with it.
No. Yeah. But I mean, I think most Americans would disagree.
Americans didn't buy German cars for a long time.
I still won't buy German cars, and I won't buy, what did my mother, it was Adidas, I think? Which one's made in France?
Oh, Adidas is
German.
German? I don't buy French or German.
There was a French sneaker that I wasn't allowed to buy as a kid, because the French cut off Israel. And my family would never buy a German car. You know, I couldn't comprehend that. It's just not happening.
I don't buy German products now.
Yeah.
I don't buy French products anymore.
Yeah, please answer the question.
Yeah.
How would Israel have survived without that money?
I don't know.
Extremely difficult.
Could they have survived?
That's right.
I mean, it's a great question, but you might not have known at that point. And by the way, I could always say, well, how did Israel ever survive? Right? You know, they seemed to find ways. I mean, on the eve of the Six-Day War, the money would have been on not surviving.
As far as the Israeli economy.
Absolutely. They were destitute.
They had to do that.
Yeah. Well, now we can say that.
And they got product that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
They needed goods, and they got it.
Yeah.
Clothing, they got it.
When did they start selling bonds?
When did they start selling bonds? Bonds were started actually back in 1902 by the World Zionist Congress.
But I meant after the war, was there a big push to sell more bonds?
I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine there wasn't. I haven't looked into that. Yeah, I can't imagine. But the World Zionist Congress was doing part of that too, for Palestine.
Part cash from bonds. Part cash from tangible
cash and bonds.
Yeah, but I mean Israel and survived the money. It was also a very effective way of getting West Germany, on behalf of the German people, to acknowledge moral culpability. Mm-hmm.
And there was another thing going on, too, and you're right, is that it created for Israel a friend in Europe. And to this day, Germany remains, I don't know if we'll have time, I have a five-minute clip on German-Israel relations. Today, it remains Israel's best friend in Europe. There have been some shaky moments in recent years, but historically, meaning since the 50s, that's been the case. So you're right, and there's a lot going on there. The Israelis, you know, needed friends. So it was I can't imagine what it must have been like to be in Israel at that point. You know, with the economy bottoming out like that and the state facing so many challenges. Remarkable.
Well, this issue almost caused the Civil War. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It came very close from what I've read.
Yeah. There's, if you want a really good book on this stuff, Tom Segev has written a book called The Seventh Million. Segev is a columnist for Haaretz, and he's written a number of really good books on Israel. Like one called 1967, one called 1948, this one, one about Holocaust survivors in general in Israel. He's really good. If you ever have a chance to hear him speak, his English is perfect. You know, grew up actually in Jerusalem with a friend of mine. He's a neat, neat guy. Some criticize him as being too liberal because he was with the Haaretz. So, you know, just to factor that in. I happen to like his stuff.
Part of the reality of this question is the relationship or lack thereof between Ben Gurion and Menachem Begin. Because there was a lot of personal stuff.
Oh, they hated each other.
And, you know, you can take sides on the particulars of whether it was a good idea, a bad idea. There's no question in my mind that it was really heightened by that personal animosity.
Right. And look, let's face it, they were both great demagogues, great speakers. They could rile people up. And they had really, I mean, actually Begin had more control over his faction, which was smaller, than Ben-Gurion had over his. I mean, Ben-Gurion was fighting his faction all the time. You know, but in part because they're larger. You know, they're in their 50s and Begin's is in the teens and the low 20s at various points. All right, anybody want to add anything for this point? All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Mr. Kastner. Okay, so now we are talking about the Kastner Affair. You might have heard the phrase about this, but this too ripped up Israel in the 50s. This was really what's deemed the first Holocaust trial in Israel, but this was different. This was a Jew. This wasn't an Eichmann type of situation. Rudolf Israel Kastner, born in Hungary, Zionist activist, journalist, and lawyer. He had a secular education, so he wasn't from that yeshiva background. He spoke and read all those languages, which are Hungarian, Romanian, French, German, Latin, Yiddish, Hebrew, and Aramaic. No slouch. His Italian was rough. Intelligent, charismatic, handsome, a dashing figure in the world. He was a teen leader of the Zionist youth groups. Remember, Germany was not at first, Hungary was not at first, this is Germany, occupied by the Nazis. Right? They didn't come in until 44. That's when Elie Wiesel, by the way, is captured around Szeged, where he's from when he's 14 years old. It's a fascist puppet state, so it cooperated, but it wasn't to the nth degree the way the Nazis were. He was an adult leader of what was called the Hungarian Aid and Rescue Committee, based in Budapest. By the way, does anybody know who else was born in Budapest?
Herzl.
You got it. Herzl. Helped Jewish refugees. Yeah, that's right. give that man some guilt.
I'll bring you the picture of the sign where his house is right next to the synagogue.
Give that man some chocolate guilt. That's what I should have brought tonight, chocolate guilt. All right, so he helped Jewish refugees escape from Nazis. They tried to get Jews into Hungary, particularly early on in the war. Hungary still had, that should say, 800,000 Jews when the Nazis occupied it in, not 800,000, it was, no, 80,000 Jews.
8,000.
No, that's wrong. When Jews occupied, the Nazis occupied it in 44, they began deportation trains. Kastner helped coordinate the deportation trains. So we know about the Judenrat in the ghettos. Some say this was a very similar situation where the Nazis would come to you and say, deliver X amount of people to the square by 5 p.m. tomorrow. If you don't, we're going to go and shoot 1,000 people, you know, starting with you. He negotiated with Eichmann about this. They negotiated to allow 1,685 Jews to leave for Switzerland at $1,000 a person. He auctioned off seats to 150 Jews to help pay for the others. Levels of controversy, obviously. Professor Eli Rechenthal says Kastner put parents, friends, and family on the train. He also put Jewish officials on, such as the Satmar Rebbe. Now, some of you may know that the great irony there is the Satmar Rebbe is vehemently anti-Zionist. Vehemently anti-Zionist. This led to allegations that he was only helping those close to him. Some say he helped redirect Jews from death camps to work camps. For the positive side, Yehuda Bauer, who is a really eminent scholar at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, says up to 20,000 were saved by Kastner. Others say he lied to them and didn't tell them that they were going to death camps or even work camps. So Kastner was a controversial fellow in his own right. But there's more to Kastner than just that. He survived the war, and he went to Israel. First, he fit in very well in Israel. He was a spokesman for the Ministry of Trade, which is now the Ministry of Trade and Industry. He ran for Knesset. He lost, but he ran for Knesset. Finally, in 1953, he's accused of having been a Nazi collaborator. This is all around the same time of the reparations. There's heightened sensitivity to this, or there would have been anyway, because of the proximity to the war. A guy named Menachiel Gruenwald writes a pamphlet, says Kastner urged Jews onto trains bound for Auschwitz, saying it would be okay, and that Kastner gave positive references to Nazis, to the Allies, after the war, enabling them to escape war crimes charges and go to Argentina or wherever else they wanted to go. You know, put in a good word for me. The trial lasted 2 years. We've talked in the past about trials in Israel can literally drag on for who knows how long. Arya Deri was on trial for 7 years. Ashaz is split, by the way, so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the election. the trial of Machiel, because the Israeli government sued Gruenwald for libel on behalf of Kastner, because Kastner worked for the government, became the trial of Kastner. His lawyers switched it around. Then Mapai was on trial, because did Mapai know about this? So it's very, very political. Then it became a trial about the Holocaust. What did you know? What didn't you know? Because there's always rumors that Ben-Gurion didn't really care that Jews were being killed in Europe. In fact, at one point during the war, Ben-Gurion even said, if I had a choice between, you know, 1,000 Jews escaping and going something, I get the numbers wrong, to England or America, and 500 coming to Palestine, I'd want the 500 to come to Palestine. Now, at that point, he didn't know it was as bad as it was. There's a whole bunch of different ways you can look at that, but there's always been some controversy about, did Ben-Gurion do enough to help Jews in the Holocaust? And there's always will be controversy, because the truth is, so many people could have done so much more, but nobody really knew how horrible it really was. 55, Judge Benjamin Halevi ruled, and he's the judge, by the way, that ruled in the Brother Daniel case, ruled that Kastner had sold his soul to the devil in exchange for the Kastner train. He didn't tell Jews that they were trains to gas chambers. He sacrificed the many to save the few. And all this actually triggered the fall of the government. Now, before we get excited, the fall of the government in Israel, as we just learned a few weeks ago, simply means that there are going to be new elections to create a new kind of mandate or confidence in the government. It doesn't necessarily mean that so-and-so is going to be out of power. But the political sniping was so bad that that's what that led to at that point. Well, we're not over even yet for Kastner. Jail time was not recommended, but he was forced to resign. He became a recluse. His wife fell into depression. His daughter had kids throwing stones at her on her way to school. The minutes after midnight on March 4th, 57, Kastner was shot as he arrived at his home in Tel Aviv, members of Lehi. They're back. We keep seeing this violence coming from these guys. And there were a handful of women, but they were almost all guys. You know, you have these guys who were ostensibly former terrorists against the British. It's not like they're going to go work in the post office. Although back then, it was a really good deal to work in the post office.
That's where they sent a lot of GIs, right?
What?
Post office, yeah.
U.S.
government. He lingered for 12 days, and then he died. The squad was convicted, and their members were sentenced to 7 years in jail. So this is Shimon Agronat. Anybody know that name? Commission after World War, after the Yom Kippur War. He's the one who had the commission after the Yom Kippur War, which Israel does after every war. It basically says, what went wrong? What lessons can we learn? I think in business, there's a term for it in business. I don't remember what it is. Maybe it's just a what do we learn wrap up, something like that. So, Agronat says, during that period, Kastner was
post-mortem.
was motivated by the sole motive of saving Hungary's Jews as a whole. That is the largest possible number under circumstances of time and place as he estimated could be saved. This motive fitted the moral duty of rescue to which he was subordinated as a leader of the Relief and Rescue Committee in Budapest. Influenced by this motive, he adopted the method of financial or economic negotiation with the Nazis. Kastner behavior stands the test of plausibility and reasonableness. So he clears them. He says he's not Judenrat. You know, he didn't send anybody to the death knowingly, or he did the best he could in a bad situation, which is probably the best way to look at it, because no choice would have been a good choice. That brings us to the really serious one, not that they're not all serious, Eichmann on trial. If you ever have the opportunity, by the way, I once read a book called Eichmann Interrogated, which I think was by Hausner, the investigator, and Gideon Hausner. It was just a transcript of the months of investigations with Eichmann.
So this guy was cleared.
Hmm?
This guy, Kastner, was cleared.
He was cleared, but he was dead.
Yeah. He was cleared after.
Correct. And who knows if that had anything to do with it. You know, posthumous judgment is usually a little kinder, particularly when it's right after your death. You know, don't speak ill of the dead. Eichmann. You know, I debated whether or not it's fair to call Eichmann the architect of the final solution. He was certainly the engineer. He put the pieces together. Right? Those guys who met in Wannsee in 1942, the suburb outside of Berlin, they might have been the architects. But they were certainly the conceptualists.
Administrator.
Administrator. That's a good word. That's a really good word. Top bureaucrat. He tackled his job with ruthless German efficiency, and he was extremely proud of it. He escaped from a work detail to Argentina as Otto Eichmann, later became Ricardo Clement. Deborah Lipstadt, about 4 or 5 years ago, came out with a really good book called Eichmann 50 Years Later, or is it Eichmann on Trial, I think it's called.
Eichmann.
Yeah, and it's about the impact of the Eichmann trial and revisiting it on Israel's consciousness. And again, that's part of that next book series, which is really good. So he was identified and captured by Israeli agents, Mossad, in May 1960. Argentina had a history of not agreeing to extradition. There's no secret that there are children, grandchildren, and whatever of Nazis living in Argentina. Ironically, right, because Baron Hirsch originally tried to start Jewish colonies there in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to allow Jews from Europe to flee.
And there are still a lot of Jews there.
Yes, there are, I want to say, 220,000 Jews. But there's kosher steakhouses, and I know some Argentinian Jews in town here, actually.
We go back. That was one of Herzl's prime spots.
That was one of his spots, yeah. Yeah. All right, so Eichmann's taken to a safe house. He's interrogated. His identity's confirmed, right? He looks like Eichmann, but we need to question him to make sure he's really Eichmann. He's smuggled out, sedated. Was sitting on the plane next to the Israeli agents. So here's Ben-Gurion. May 23rd, 1960, he walks up to the Knesset rostrum, right? They're in the middle of debating. Okay, he's prime minister, so he's going to walk up. He's, Mr. Speaker, you mind if I have something to say? Sure, say whatever you want to say. I must inform the Knesset that some time ago, Israeli security forces tracked down one of the greater Nazi criminals, Adolf Eichmann, who was in charge, together with the Nazi leadership, of what they refer to as the final solution to the Jewish problem, meaning the extermination of 6 million members of the Jewish community of Europe. Adolf Eichmann is already held in custody in Israel and would soon be brought to trial in accordance with the Nazis and Nazi collaborators law, 5710-1950. Everybody's hushed, then everybody's buzzing. Everybody, you know, where is he? What's going on? He just walks away. Just goes back to his office. Ben-Gurion didn't want to deal with it. Stunned everybody. Absolutely stunned everybody. Of course, for the trial, they had a bulletproof glass. They wanted to make sure that Eichmann wasn't assassinated. He was watched by a guard 24/7 to make sure he didn't hurt himself. He's charged with crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, war crimes, and membership of an outlawed organization. Which is interesting, right? There's two places in the world where the Nazi Party is outlawed. Germany and Israel. You know, and that's an interesting freedom of speech issue as well. Because they're certainly not outlawed in this country. They find a lawyer, a German lawyer, who will defend Eichmann. He defends criminals and former Nazis. Zervasius, I guess it's pronounced. He raises some really interesting points. He said, Eichmann's captured illegally, right? The crimes didn't take place in Israel. Why? How can you even think of trying him here? Send him to Germany! He can't mount a defense because his Nazi buddies can't come here. Because if they do, they'll be arrested. And he didn't create the genocidal policy, he just carried it out. That's the famous phrase, I was just following orders. Legally, something like crimes didn't take place in Israel, you know, these are special circumstances, but that's a really fascinating point.
It's a
what?
It's a
but he's pr- probably better than Johnny Cochran. So meanwhile, the prosecution doesn't want to rely solely on documents and eyewitnesses. They could always come into question. It was 8 years, it was 15 years ago, you're 85 years old now, do you really remember that? So-and-so contradicts that. So they begin interrogating Eichmann for months, right? 3,500 pages. 3,500 pages in German, so there's no question. Or they have a Jew who was raised speaking German, Gideon Hausner. He was caught in half lies. You know, oh, I thought you said such and such, and this guy was really good. The trial begins in 61. There's three judges. Remember we mentioned last week the Israel Supreme Court can have 3, 5, 7, 11, 19 judges, whatever it chooses to have. You guys have been to Beit HaAm, the big hall, city the convention center in Jerusalem. You know, then it was just recently built. It's been redone a few times now. So they hold the trial there because there's no courthouse big enough, because they purposely invite the world media and observers to come. Because they say, or Ben-Gurion says, and this is, you know, we think about it now, but this is 63, he says, or 61, we have a generation that's being raised that doesn't know about the Holocaust. Now, why don't they know about the Holocaust, the young people, so close to the Holocaust? Any thoughts?
Survivors never spoke.
Survivors never spoke, that's right. Leave me alone, I just want to live my life.
And Israel wasn't going to necessarily teach about the Holocaust in the school system.
Right.
Too
hurt.
Right.
Too painful. Right.
Also, there was a stigma about how these people survived the camps. How did they get in? How did they get captured without fighting back, you know, like sheep?
Right. And we're actually going to get to that point in a little bit. And in terms of the way the Israelis view the Holocaust. Absolutely. So Eichmann's in a bulletproof case or class. So finally, it's an international sensation. Live TV broadcast in Israel. Films flown from Jerusalem to New York every day. Hannah Arendt for the New Yorker is sitting in the galleys, and she goes on to write various articles that become her book, The Banality of Evil. A very controversial, and Lipstadt's book goes into that quite well. 56-day trial, so not quite 2 months. 112 witnesses, hundreds of documents. August 14th, the verdict is read. August 14th, the verdict is read December 12th. He is guilty for deplorable conditions on deportation trains. He is guilty of finding Jews to fill those trains. He is guilty of crimes against humanity and war crimes. He is guilty of membership in organizations deemed criminal at Nuremberg, including the Gestapo and the SS, and he's not merely following orders, but he believed in the Nazi cause, it's supposed to be wholeheartedly, and he had been a key perpetrator of genocide. Eichmann is put to death after his appeals are winding their ways through the court system. Eichmann remains the only person put to death in non-war time activity by the Israeli government. All right. The only death penalty in Israel is crimes against humanity and crimes against the Jewish people.
Didn't they outlaw the death penalty after that?
I believe it is still in the books. I haven't heard that, but I'll check into that. I'll check into that. But my understanding is it's still in the books. I'll check into it. all right. So that's Eichmann. So here we have the Holocaust in daily life. For Israel. Now, it's a raison d'etre for the state in some regards. Right? Because, of course, we say, if there had been an Israel then, what a different world it would be today. And we talked a little bit about that in the beginning of class today. Keep in mind, this impacted everything and continues to. Let's look at that excerpt from the Israel Declaration of Independence. The catastrophe which recently befell the Jewish people, the massacre of millions of Jews in Europe, was another clear demonstration by the urgency of solving the problem of its homelessness by reestablishing in Eretz Israel the Jewish state, which would open the gates of the homeland wide to every Jew and confer upon the Jewish people the status of a fully privileged member of the Comity of Nations. So right there, they're saying a purpose of the state is to make sure there's no more Holocausts. Purpose of the state is we know that had there been a state, the Holocaust at least would not have been as severe. It's very hard to argue against that, by the way. A lot later, in fact, 50 years later, when he's chief of staff, before he becomes defense minister and then prime minister, Ehud Barak is at Auschwitz with a delegation of the army, and he says, "We, the soldiers of the Israeli Defense Forces, have come to this year place 50 years later, perhaps 50 years too late." Now, put yourself in the place of a survivor, or a child, or a grandchild of a survivor. It's very, very powerful. And remember, this is still a country ruled by Ashkenazi survivors, their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Or if not ruled, certainly with an overwhelmingly large number of those people. The Holocaust immediately began having an impact on Israeli life, not just by the fact that hundreds of thousands of survivors started showing up in the country. There was a weekly radio program called Searching for Relatives Bureau. It started in 1945 by the Jewish agencies and went to the late 60s. And, you know, I've listened to some of that, and basically they just say, Sonia Hirschfeld is searching for Chaim Schwartzman from Lubansk, Poland. And then they go on to the next name, and then they do this for about a half an hour. And it's really amazing, because all these survivors came, and they couldn't find anybody. So they would all sit around the radio and listen to this. I think it was on Tuesday, late afternoon or evening. They renewed it when the Russians started arriving in the late 80s, early 90s, because there were more Holocaust survivors and more people who knew what was going on. There are programs like the March of the Living. Is anyone familiar with that? So March of the Living brings a couple thousand Jewish teenagers for Holocaust Memorial Day to Auschwitz, to Poland. And you see pictures of a lot of the Israeli kids wrapped in big Israeli flags, you know, walking along there. And a lot of American kids there, and it's very, very powerful. A lot of the Israeli kids are secular, but really relate to this as part of their identity. 1992, the study of Israeli identity among teachers, college students, close to 80% agree we're all Holocaust survivors. That's a really, really interesting statistic, because they're not all Ashkenazi. And I've spoken to Sephardi Jews, and they've said to me in Israel, you know, we look at it as if it happened to us too. Really do. It's very, very, very interesting. So what I want to show you now is a clip, I think this is the right clip, of Auschwitz, IDF jets flying over Auschwitz. They're doing it on the same day names of those murdered are being read, right? September 3rd, 2003. We know that on that day, because the Germans kept meticulous records, 661 Jews from Darcy, France, immediately were sent to the death chamber. Drancy, sorry.
D-R-A.
Yeah. That's what you get for doing it too late. All right. Let's take a look and see what we got. Can you grab a... Michelle, can you grab a light?
Yep.
I got
a word.
All right. This is Chana Senesh's famous poem. She was killed parachuting into Hungary to rescue Jews. I believe this is 1993. 2003, 2003, sorry. I assume she's the granddaughter or great-granddaughter of survivors. They usually do that.
לעצום עיניים ולראות מסחר ער בכיכר טיקטין, לשמוע חכמים מתפלפלים בישיבת לובלין, את הרמה הפוסק בתורה, לדמיין העיירה היהודית חיה ותוססת. באנו כדי לעבור בשבילי השמדת עם, ללכת ברחובות הגטאות, לפסוע ביער אל בורות ההריגה, להיכנס בשערי מחנות המוות, לנסות לדמיין את גודל האסון, האישי, המשפחתי, הקולקטיבי. באנו לומר לקורבנות ההשפלה וההשמדה שאפרה מונח כאן לרגלנו, לאלה שהומתו מיד עם הגעת הטרנספורט ולאלה שקודם למותם נטפה עם דעתם מעוצמת הרעב, הקור, ההשפלה וההתמודדות היומית עם שפל מנהג אדם ואדם. אנחנו כאן, למרות הכל. ההתנגדות היהודית
והעוצמה
אדירה, רוח הקרב שלכם חיה ומפעמת בו.
These pilots are the grandchildren of survivors. Gets me.
Alright,
so very, very powerful. I remember when it happened and watching it over and over and just always trying to think about what they would think. You know, we know they cheered when periodically over whatever camp an Allied plane would fly over. Can you imagine? A Jewish star.
One other date I would put in there, and that's in terms of a recognition in Israel about the Holocaust and what it meant. In 1981, I think it was, a world gathering of Holocaust survivors in Israel. And I think there were over 5,000 Holocaust survivors in there.
It's probably a World Jewish Congress thing, or?
No, it was sponsored by an organization called the World Gathering of, World Gathering of Holocaust Survivors, which then became the American Holocaust Survivors, the It's like they're different groups.
I was there with my dad. My old buddy Menachem Rosenkraft, I think.
Right.
Rosenkraft.
Rosenkraft.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's one in Berlin in August.
Oh, really? Oh, they got the new museum there. It's not that new anymore, but yeah.
What also happened in, I think it was 1981, where Malcolm Begin ordered the destruction of the Iraqi nuclear reactors. So that was kind of a juxtaposition.
That's interesting. That's interesting. All right, so you're getting a feel of the constant, you know, specter of the Holocaust in Israeli life. It's almost always there. It's going to be, you know, both very, very challenging and difficult and interesting to see in 20, 30, 40 years what it's going to mean. Because then we'll have grandchildren and great-grandchildren and survivors running the country. The big day in Israel, of course, is Holocaust Memorial Day. Now, interestingly enough, it's the formal name is Yom HaZikaron LeShoah VeLeGevura. Holocaust and Heroism Remembrance Day. Now, the Israelis did that on purpose. They didn't want it all to be about death and destruction. So there was a great emphasis, to the extent you can, on not just survival, but resistance. It was very, very important. Knesset approved, that was back in 51. In 53, they formally started doing it. The legislation was approved in 51. Originally, they couldn't do it on the 27th of Nisan, which was the first night of Pesach. Or not the first night of Pesach, but that year was when Pesach was. That's always on the 15th of Nisan. It was the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, I'm sorry. I'm remembering the Pesach when we did the thing for the Warsaw Ghetto, actually. I'll have to look into that, but there was some controversy as to when it could start, so which is why it's on the date today. And looking at it now, I realize it doesn't quite make sense to me. It starts at sundown with a state ceremony at the Warsaw Ghetto Square in Yad Vashem. Prime Minister often speaks at it. By law, places of public entertainment are closed. It's not private ones, not movie theaters, but museums, libraries, things like that. TV has documentaries. Radio shows often have somber music. There's a lot of talk shows about it. The nation focuses on Holocaust Memorial Day, just like in a little bit they'll focus on Israel Memorial Day and the next day Israel Independence Day. This is the period of the Yoms, you know, in about a week and a half or so. 10 a.m., air raid sirens sound, people pause for a minute, all flags are at half-mast. The Haredi community doesn't observe in general Yom HaShoah, some do, but on Tisha B'Av, if you go to a Haredi synagogue, or really any Orthodox synagogue now, many of the readings are about the Holocaust. So, and indeed, by the way, I had a great opportunity once. I sat and talked with Elie Wiesel for a long time, and I said to him, you know, nobody remembers anything about the expulsion from Spain. How do you expect that we're going to be able to remember stuff about the Holocaust in 100, let alone 500 years? And he said to me, that's the reason why I argued that Holocaust Memorial Day should be wrapped into Tisha B'Av, because they're always going to remember Tisha B'Av. He said, you're right. So, and there's talk of that periodically. Frankly, it makes sense to me. But there's a link with the Warsaw Ghetto that I also understand.
What's the thinking behind Haredi?
Oh, sure, that's a great question. It's a very fair question. The thinking is logical. Understand it from their perspective. There's nothing religious about saying that's Holocaust Memorial Day. Now, when you do Yisker, there's prayer in most books. That's fair. But everything they do has a religious perspective and a relationship to God. And from their perspective, so you secular Jews pick that day? What? I'm going to do special prayers on that day? So, put yourself in their perspective. I disagree with them. But I understand it from their perspective.
I'm trying.
Okay, that's fine. In Israel, educators noticed as early as the 1950s, the mid-50s, that the younger kids, the students, weren't relating to the Holocaust survivors and the Holocaust in general. So they started putting a focus on passive resistance, because the concept of resistance is something they could understand, the kids, because it's Israel, right? So it's been said that every day we stayed alive was an act of resistance. That's different than saying they beat us and pushed us into cattle cars. So they know that's an issue. So now I have a much briefer clip of Yom HaShoah in Israel. And then we take a quick look at that. This is really remarkable.
It's
Tel Aviv. So, not one of these people in appearance were Orthodox. They're all secular. And it just fascinates me in many regards that they're conditioned to do this. You know, they grew up like this.
Last year's Shin Shanim took it very seriously.
Explain what Shin Shanim are.
Every year, in Baltimore, we get two young people between high school and their army, going into the army, a boy and a girl, who come and teach in the different schools, the religious schools and the day schools. They come over usually from our partner city in Ashkelon. And they have Shin Shanim in different cities around the United States, and they come and they teach in religious schools. So last year's took the Memorial Days very seriously, and they showed all their students this, and also we're talking about that when they have Memorial Days for Yom HaZikaron and also for Yom HaShoah, that really everybody, all you do is you watch the documentaries, it's your day to remember.
Yeah.
They took it very seriously.
The concept, the impact, the psychology of the Holocaust is always there in Israel. Always there. And we're going to look at a couple quick examples. We've got about 10 minutes left. What I call the chilled shadow of the Holocaust regarding Iran. This is obviously the most prominent one. We know that, you know, I think, you know, you're to be kind. You haven't been taking your medication if you don't think Iran wants a nuclear weapon right now. I took mine, so that's why I know that. Netanyahu's gut reaction. This is from Yom HaShoah this past year. In this place, I have said many times that we must identify an existential threat in time and act against it in time. And tonight I ask why, in the years before the Holocaust, did most of the world's leaders not see the danger ahead of time? In hindsight, all the signs were there. Has the world learned a lesson from the mistakes of the past? Today we are again faced with clear facts and before a real danger. Iran calls for our destruction. It develops nuclear weapons. Netanyahu makes the Iranian issue his number one issue with the Obama administration, and certainly Obama himself, every time they meet, whether or not Obama has other things on his mind. Some of you remember, I guess it was 2-3 years ago, he spoke at the UN where he drew the picture of the bomb. It was very, you know, powerful presentation. You can read all types of things that the Iranians won't have capability, you know, for 6 more days versus 60 more years. But no one really is saying that they don't want to try this. Now, Israel knows this because Israel secretly built the bomb. Right? Israel knows how to do this. And it's probably a little easier to do it today than it was then. The fact aside that Iranian scientists have received a couple explosive types of letters in the mail.
Is that the only reason?
That what?
That they can't develop a bomb?
You know what? I just don't know. Part of it would be the embargo. I mean, the problem with this type of stuff is you don't know what you don't know. So there's an embargo against Iran. Foreign assets are frozen in many places. So there's certainly been roadblocks in the way. You know, some scientists have been killed, probably by Israel.
Unfortunately, they recovered from Stuxnet.
Right. And I remember that. And not the Arab states are trying to block them too, right? The Saudis don't want them to have the bomb. So we don't know. And apparently it takes a long time. They have, I don't remember the last time I heard, 3,000 or 5,000 centrifuges going.
About 36,000.
36,000?
36,000.
Wow.
Right. So by the middle of next year, they'll have 50,000. In spite of the fact that we have said they can't do that.
Right.
And the president has said he will stop them.
Says a lot of things.
Well, you know.
Chicken licking told
you. They have 36,000 centrifuges? Where, yes. Do you remember where you saw that?
It's documented in the...
No, I believe you. I just want to read it. Yeah. If you see it, let me know. Okay. So that's two things you got me looking up. Okay. So he often sees himself as preventing another Holocaust. He's talked about that a great deal. A great deal. He takes it very seriously. Remember, his father was the revisionist Zionist who was the secretary for Jabotinsky. So, 2001, when Ariel Sharon was prime minister, and he was being forced to agree to various potential concessions with the Palestinians, he said, and Sharon's born in Israel, as is Netanyahu. Israel will not be Czechoslovakia. I turn to the Western democracies, first and foremost the leader of the free world, the United States. Do not repeat the dreadful mistake of 1938 when the enlightened democracies of Europe decided to sacrifice Czechoslovakia for the sake of a temporary convenient solution. Don't try to appease the Arabs at our expense. We will not accept this. Israel will not be Czechoslovakia. This really irritated the Bush administration at that time. Really irritated, and Condoleezza Rice in particular. But Bush was said to be ticked off too. He was not fast friends with Sharon as he would become in the coming years. But the point I'm showing, hopefully, is that the Holocaust is a daily factor in the lives of Israelis and their leaders. I'm not going to do anything on German-Israel relations today. There's a video to see, but we talked a little bit about how Germany is really the closest friend to Israel. And this was from a year ago, this picture of Angela Merkel and Netanyahu. So we end with, let's pick one or two questions. I'm going to give you guys 3 minutes. I'm going to ask you in groups of two or three or whatever to consider these questions. And let me make them a little bigger for us. Whoops. Does the heavy emphasis on Holocaust memory help or hurt the normalization of the Jewish people that many saw the state is intended to do, which means normalize the state? Or as time marches on, should Israel put more or less emphasis on the Holocaust as being a reason for the state. We have 5 minutes left. I'll give you 3, and then we'll talk about it. So you guys pick one of those questions, and we'll go.
Just do it as a group.
Want to do it as a group?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So I turn to the first question. There's a heavy emphasis on Holocaust memory. The goal of the state for many people was to quote-unquote normalize the Jewish people. So,
what does that mean?
We're a nation like all other nations. Ben-Gurion once said, when the telephone repairman climbing the pole and the prostitute are Jewish, then we'll be like everyone else.
There has to be acceptance on the part of the rest of the world, and I can never see that happen.
Yeah, okay. I'm just thinking the same thing.
We have to protect.
But we're not like everybody else because it's the only religious country.
Well, there's some Islam, a lot of Muslim states that officially
they make no bones about it.
Yeah.
Even some of the European states have crosses in their
right, Switzerland, right,
and the Vatican.
The Vatican is not technically a state, although they have a foreign minister.
Yes. And an army.
I think Holocaust or not will always be the other.
Okay. Well, I mean, I tend to agree with what you guys are saying. For me, Jewish people aren't normal. I have no problem with that. The Jewish people just aren't normal. They're not like everyone else for a whole bunch of reasons, some internal and some external.
Well, and every country has their history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Armenians had their massacres and...
Right.
The American Indians certainly don't give up on the Trail of Tears and what happened to them.
But it's an interesting question to go back to something we were talking about a little while ago. In 50 years, what impact will it make? What will Israel be, quote-unquote, without the Holocaust? Right? And again, I go back to the expulsion from Spain. Jewish people don't remember the expulsion from Spain, which was equally traumatic in its era.
Well, I'll say a couple of things. First of all, technology is such that they didn't have the ability
Absolutely.
To transmit from the time of the expulsion from Spain the way we do now
mm-hmm.
to document and transmit information. But also, I think that it will always be a touchstone for some element of Jewish identity. And I know Mizrahi people in Israel who do not identify with the Holocaust at all, and they feel mm-hmm. uncomfortable about this emphasis in their country and their society. And I don't know if the question is putting more or less emphasis on the Holocaust as being a reason for the state is really quite the question. It is a thread woven into the fabric of everything that is historical and moving forward about Israel will always be part of the desperate history of the Jewish people to survive.
Yeah, I kind of agree with the last part of your statement, not that I disagree with the first, but the last part of your statement of it's not the only, Israel, there was the whole Zionism prior to the Holocaust, so there's mm-hmm. this constant yearning for Jews to come back to the land of Israel. The Holocaust maybe pushed it along a little bit faster in a way, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's the only reason that the state's going to be there. It is there.
The Israeli narrative moves away from the fact that the purpose of the state is because of the Holocaust. They're moving away from that, saying we
right,
have a right
to,
yeah, that we have a right to have a country, and part of our history is the Holocaust. Because if you believe that Israel was a guilty response for the rest of the world to what happened to the Jews, then that feeds the narrative of the Jew of the people who don't support Israel. That Jews have no right to be there.
Right.
Jews have a right to be in Israel because it was their country. They were driven off from it. And now they've come home again. And the Holocaust is just one more thing rather than it was given to, that Palestine was given to Israel because the rest of the world felt guilty about what happened. That feeds the wrong narrative.
Right.
I don't mean to be devil's advocate.
Yes,
more
you
a cautionary
yes, you do.
Tone. I think that the Holocaust can be both self-deceptive and used as an excuse for masking actions which are maybe not in Israel's best interest. I mean, too often I think we hear as a excuse or rationale for anything that some Israelis or Jews want to do that, well, the world is against us. The world
right,
wants to kill
right.
us.
Never again.
You know, and sometimes, you know, that's to justify actions that, you know,
sure.
in some cases
sure.
are really unwise and dangerous. And I think some of that mentality seeps into some of the settler ideology.
Oh, definitely.
And that can be dangerous.
So I wish I could be as optimistic as some of you guys on the lasting impact of the Holocaust. But for me, at least, and you're right about the technology, could be a game changer, but the further you move away from it, the less you're going to know about it, ironically, in a moment when the historians are going to know more and more about it, because the institutes that have been set up and what have you, hang on a second, it's going to become a really bad event in history, but nothing like the psychology today. And I'm going to be fascinated. I won't be here to see it. I don't know if any of you guys will. In 100 years, to see if people stop in the street on Yom HaShoah. I don't know. I just don't know. Jewish history tells me otherwise. You know, Jewish history just tells me otherwise.
I was just thinking, you were talking about how we don't remember the expulsion from Spain, but the only reason I do know it is because it's a touchstone for somebody I know who was Sephardi.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sephardis, for them, it's still a touchstone.
I don't know for too many of them. I mean, for example, there's no expulsion from Spain Day, Gerush Mitzvara Day. There are a lot of Ladino poems and songs, but people don't speak Ladino anymore, or very few. You know, the other example I like to give is when the temple was destroyed the second time, we created some prayers. Right, there's a prayer in traditional prayer books at the end of the Amida that says, "May the temple be rebuilt speedily in our days." But people just blip through that, you know, like all the prayers.
It's there now.
But it doesn't resonate, you know. So I'm just not optimistic about it.
But it might resonate with people who regularly say those prayers.
I mean,
yeah, but
I don't know.
Once they're no longer here,
I don't know. I mean, I go to plenty of Orthodox synagogues.
Being rebuilt.
Yeah, they want Mashiach now for that temple.
Yeah, I just don't think it resonates. You know, I just think it's, you know, I don't know if anybody's like me, but, you know, I'm thinking of Kiddush. You know? You know? Who sponsored it today? Oh, that means it'll be a good one. You know?
If you're me, you're saying, how many pages are
left? Right, yeah, how many pages? Oh, God, it's only 11:30. Anyway, thank you. That was a very good conversation. When we come back, who's that man? It's not Ringo Starr's father.
Obadiah Yosef.
Yeah, who knows?
Well, he might be back for the election.
That's right.
But his daughter is not running.
I know, I saw that actually. I read that in Times of Israel, actually. All right, guys, have a wonderful break. Chag Sameach.